Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Friday morning. It is the 13th of April, which, yes, makes it Friday the 13th. Just let that sink in for a second. Okay. It's Friday the 13th. Well, but looking at the news, it certainly doesn't seem like it, does it? No, 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 no. We have a...
Trekophobia? Not I.
Not us. No. Well, first of all, coming in, the music you heard, that was Ruby Boots and a great album, Don't Talk About It. That was the title track. And Ruby Boots is going to be headlining the Roots Music Festival at the Linda tomorrow night. And you can find out more by going to thelinda.org. And people ask us this all the time. What's the music that you play? Well, we always put the playlist up on our website. So if you just go to wamc.org/roundtable, the playlist is right there. It's as simple as that. Okay, let me get around to introducing our stellar panel this morning. We welcome you to join us to panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. WAMC's Alan Shartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Yo-jo. Fine.
Good. Good to hear you. Good to hear you. And Mike Spain is here. We Judith Eng would normally be with us. Judith had a travel engagement, so she switched with Mike. Mike came in and filled in for her, and we're thrilled. Thank you very much, Mike Spain, Associate Editor of the Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having me. And they're big shoes to fill. I won't be able to, but I'll do my best.
I'm sure you'll do fine. Also, he's a counterterrorism expert. He is an MSNBC commentator. He is a best-selling author. He is our dear friend and Malcolm Nance, good morning. How are you?
There's nothing good about this morning. This will be some of the most awesome radio in the history of this station.
You took Alan's line. All right. Well, we'll try to make it good. Aaron Pasidi is here. He is a professor of economics at Siena College, and we're thrilled that he is here each and every Friday. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you with us. All right. Now, let's get to a reminder, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. There is so much to talk about, and you really could start anywhere. So we have the TPP, we have Syria, we have the Comey book. Does anybody have a favorite that they would like to start off with this morning?
Comey!
Okay, you want to start with Comey?
Yeah, you have to start there.
Okay, we're going to start with James Comey. We have a request for the Comey story. The name of the book is A Higher Loyalty. It is by James Comey, you know, the former FBI director who was fired about a year ago by the President of the United States. Donald Trump asked Director James Comey of the FBI to investigate and knock down a lurid but unverified report that placed Mr. Trump years earlier in a Moscow hotel suite with prostitutes, explaining to Mr. Comey that the fantastic story was untrue and was painful and distressing to his wife, Melania. Mr. Comey describes two January 2017 conversations between himself and Mr. Trump in A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. Mr. Comey's new memoir is set to be released on Tuesday. The New York Times acquired a copy of the book before its release, and accounts of the exchange appeared in reports by several other news organizations on Thursday evening. By Comey's accounts, Mr. Trump, then the president-elect, disputed the so-called Steele dossier, a document compiled by a former British intelligence officer that detailed an allegation in which Mr. Trump watched prostitutes urinate on each other. Mr. Comey writes that Mr. Trump insisted that there's no way I would let people pee on each other around me, in part because he was a self-professed germaphobe. No way. 4 months later, Mr. Trump abruptly fired Mr. Comey, setting in motion a cascade of political and legal consequences that led directly to the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel overseeing the Russia investigation. This morning, we should note that the president has been tweeting out regarding James Comey, and an hour ago said James Comey is a proven leaker and liar. Virtually everyone in Washington thought he should be fired for the terrible job he did until he was, in fact, fired. He leaked classified, all capital letters, information for which he should be prosecuted. He lied to Congress under oath, all capitalized. He is a weak and untruthful slime ball who was, as time has proven, a terrible director of the FBI. His handling of the crooked Hillary case and the events surrounding it will go down as one of the worst botch jobs in quotations, of history. It was my great honor to fire James Comey.
My great honor.
Oh, my God. The man admits obstruction of justice to the entire nation via tweet. It's just utterly amazing, the times that we live in.
And you know what? There is an irony here, isn't there, folks? And that is that Comey, for all his alleged faults from the president, and I do say alleged because, after all, he is a Republican. He's one of the most distinguished. His service is one of the most distinguished in the history of United States law enforcement and all of the rest. But there is a good argument to be made. He won the election for Trump. He came out with that stuff about that nonsense about Hillary at the last minute. And a lot of people think that's what made the election Trump's. Incredible.
This is how Trump treats people.
The timing of that was, you know, suspicious in terms of the election. But the other irony that I saw is the title of Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, because the conversation between Trump and Comey, where Trump asked for loyalty and Comey promised honesty. I mean, that is a giant stick in the eye from Comey to Trump, and I like that.
And let's remember, and let's remember
I'm a straight-up masochist or sadist.
And let's remember that one of the prime points from Comey is that this reminds him of when he was putting all the mafia bosses in jail. Same guy, same temperament about loyalty, personal loyalty, omerta, silence, and all the rest of it. That's extraordinary. And by the way, while we're on the subject, I just wanted to mention the idea, the ludicrousness that he would hide behind Melania on this one.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? Because Melania, who some people say, oh, poor Melania, get out of my way. You know, the fact of the matter is, it's not poor Melania. Melania has a job. I'm sure there's all kinds of agreements about who gets what and prenups and everything else. But Melania has certainly not been a courageous person in any of this. And the idea that she would all of a sudden be the one who would be offended that he hides behind is beyond my comprehension.
Well, I thought it was a rare exhibition of empathy and compassion on the part of the president when he brought that up. You don't see that often.
Rare is the word.
You know, so does it seems to me, because we assume that Comey will be the guy who takes the high road, right? And tries to, you know, paint this picture as you say, a higher loyalty, a higher calling of looking to this as taking the high road. He does write, however, his face appeared slightly orange with bright white half moons under his eyes, where I assumed he plays small tanning goggles. He said Mr. Trump had impressively coiffed bright blonde hair, which upon close inspection looked to be all his. And then he goes on to talk about the size of his hands, which seemed to be in proportion, but he did notice because of...
But isn't that just honest factual reporting from an FBI
director?
No,
that is the FBI.
That's good observation.
The former FBI director really sticking it in the eye yet again, Aaron.
Well, and one other thing, and selling some books. I mean, I can just imagine what that conversation with the agent and the publisher must have been like.
I just went through two brutal weeks with my editors on my new book. And they were constantly asking me for color commentary like that. Why don't you put yourself in this scene? How did you feel about that? And it's like, I'm talking about terrorists. So, you know, publishers do that. And I can easily see, as soon as I heard that, I thought, oh, yeah, they wanted him to be very descriptive. And and it was probably one of the five big reveals.
There are so many nuggets in this book. I think the press is trying to catch up, and the few people that have read the book are doing what they can. One of the details is that after Mr. Comey was fired, John Kelly, who was then Secretary of Homeland Security, would go on to become Mr. Trump's second chief of staff, called Comey and said he was sick about the firing, intended to quit in protest. Saying, I urge Kelly not to do that, arguing that the country needed principled people around the president, especially this president. And here's the question I have, though. This is somewhat strikes me similarly to the Michael Flynn book, which is, no, what is the guy's name? Michael, Fire and Fury.
Fire and Fury.
Oh, yeah. Fire and Fury. I can't think of the name of the, but that, okay, but this, but
there's really nothing new.
Is there anything like surprise? Like the guy is vain. And
I think that's a good point. The testimony that Comey did before the Congress after he was fired seems to have told this narrative already. What we're getting are these little tidbits, like the way he reacted to Trump's orange face and the personal disgust he had with the way that Trump was behaving and talking. But factually, he's already made the case for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, but he is, Mike, I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Michael Wolff, by the way, I'm sorry.
That's it.
He is the former FBI director. A lot of people think, by the way, that his firing Comey, Trump's firing Comey, was what is going to, in the end, have brought him down. That if he hadn't done that, he might be surviving right now. And there are a lot of folks who believe that.
So let's go to Malcolm Nance, who started this program by saying he admitted obstruction to justice on Twitter this morning.
Yeah, also, he admitted obstruction of justice last year when he came out and said the day after the, you know, with the Russian, well, actually Lester Holt's interview.
Lester Holt on NBC.
That he fired him because of the Russia investigation. And he started it out with the lie that we now know is a lie. That,
I believe you referred to it as the Russian thing.
The Russian thing.
Is that a thing?
You know, but by coming out and making this admission, it shows, it goes to your intent. I really wish we had a lawyer on the panel today, but it goes to your intent about what you intended to do and why you intended to do it. If you wanted to do it like a mafia don to stop a federal investigation into your activities, that's the technical definition of obstruction of justice. And then today he comes back out, it was an honor to fire Comey. I mean, man, stop digging this hole. I mean, his presidential grave is dug.
And Malcolm, not only are you right about that, but it wasn't only Lester Holt. Remember, he said it to the Russians.
Next day, he's bragging to the Russians.
Which I interpreted to mean, bring this back to Putin and tell him I'm a good guy.
Yeah, I'm a good schmo.
I'm on board. But there was another example of public obstruction of justice with the whole fiasco over the Sean Hannity show two nights ago. When Trump directly invited people to go on and ask for Rob Rosenstein to be fired to sort of set up the premise that he could react to. But he's the one who set it all up. And who plays right along with it is Hannity and the Fox team. I mean, it's collusion.
Fair and balanced is what it is.
Said that Trump literally acted as executive producer of that, coordinated it, handed out the message. If that's the case, then what you have right here is Fox News itself can be implicated in a continuing conspiracy against the United States.
You know, I was reading the excerpts of the book and of what was published last night. I'm going through it, and of course, you know, it's like catnip. It's just great. Yeah. It's, you know, you have to like keep dabbing your lip because you're drooling. I mean, it's just so great. But. Then you get to the point where Comey starts to defend himself and his handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation, and you start to shudder a little bit and think, why did you do that? It did, I don't know, in my reading of it, it still doesn't seem, I mean, he's obviously talked about it before, but it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. And to put up this whole thing as you're writing about Trump that, you know, I'm going to be above the law and I'm going to go out on a, you know, if you go with the truth and what is right and with the law, you're on the right side. And then you look at what happened there and it makes your stomach curl a little bit.
It's a brilliant observation, Joe, on your part. But I have to say he was trying to deal with it in the book. And if you read the excerpts, where he says that when he saw the outcome of the election, he was nauseated. And he was really worried that he had been the one who had done that. He was dealing, I think, factually with his own downside in all of this. And I think he suspected who the people who were going to read this book were and where their allegiance and where their allegiances were.
He said that Mr. Comey, in the article, says Mr. Comey acknowledges that he thought Mrs. Clinton would win the presidency and said it is entirely possible that he decided to reveal that the email investigation had started up again 11 days before the election because he was primarily concerned that if he concealed the renewed investigation, it would make her an illegitimate president. Would he have made a different decision if Mr. Trump had been ahead in the polls? I don't know, Mr. Comey concedes. My question is, but who is he to make that?
Exactly.
I know, but yeah. I have to tell you, the full disclosure, the year before, I gave a debate. I had a debate with an FBI officer, senior FBI officer, at a private forum, and the bureau was all Trump. All of them, to a man. Every bureau guy I met was all thumbs up, double thumbs up for Trump. And to say that that agency was working for Clinton, or as you see, Trump understands that, right, too. Trump always says, it's the senior management that's corrupt. I have to clear them out. And what he wants to do is, he wants to do what he's doing at DHS, is move up loyalists who will commit crimes for the presidency. And now, look, I don't feel ashamed saying that, because that is what we're talking about here. People in this cabinet who were willing to commit crimes in order to stop that. And for, say what you will about Comey, he was not willing to betray the Constitution.
What shocked me, though, was the part that he said he sat down with Obama in later November after the election. And Obama essentially said to him, I picked you as the FBI director because of your integrity and your ability. I want you to know that nothing has happened in the last year to change my view. And that brought Comey to tears. Yeah. And even Chuck Schumer grabbed him after a congressional hearing and said, I know you were in an impossible position, in an impossible position. So it sounds like he's rationalizing it, using those top Democrats to validate what he did to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I miss Obama. I would really like to have president of the United States.
He writes fondly of Obama. Comey does take shots at Condoleezza Rice.
Worthy.
And also David Addington, who is a top advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney.
I wonder why.
That he says the war on terrorism justified stretching of not breaking the written law.
Well, Cheney's in the news today. We can talk about it later.
All right.
After Cohen.
Okay, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll talk more about this and other stuff. Yes, there is other stuff, and we'll get to that. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It's the 13th of April, and we are thrilled you are with us. Alan Chartok is with us as well. Mike Spain, Malcolm Nance, and Aaron Pasitti. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Let's go to some letters, and then we'll talk about some other stuff as well. Christian says, Kellyanne Conway accused James Comey of taking unnecessary, immature potshots at Trump in his book. When making this statement, did she ever consider the conduct of the man she works for? Well, no.
Kellyanne Conway? Don't ever mention her name in front of me.
It's more of that Chutz Bass stuff.
That woman is funny. Congenital liar. I'm
You'd
sorry.
Like that, Alan?
I've experienced that personally. She has no room to criticize anyone.
Mary says about Melania, as a woman previously married in this situation, it's not about the money, it's custody. While she has a minor child, she won't want to do anything to upset that apple cart. Mike says, I'm very disappointed in Comey charging $1,000 to see him at a book signing. He's just giving the attackers fuel to the fire to discredit this as a marketing media stunt.
Private citizen.
Well, all right. If he can make a grand, he's, then do it. I don't know.
He's lucky he has a pension.
I mean, I kind of agree with that point, though. I mean, if you're going out and calling the current administration and White House a forest fire, that's a public service, and to charge that much, I think.
Yeah, but I don't know. I have to read more about the event. Sure, he's doing public events that don't cost $1,000.
Sure.
But you know, whatever.
And then there's always the question of who's getting the $1,000.
Right, who's getting the money, where is it going, and so I have to look that up. Karen says, no fan of Comey, he absolutely sunk Hillary Clinton's campaign in the last days of the 2016 election. Now he's cashing in on the Trump presidency with his book. Well, that is true. He got a lot of money for the book. The guy he helped elect, I don't have a bit of sympathy or admiration for him. It's all too depressing. Malcolm, too depressing for you?
Yes, it is too depressing for me. Did someone mention it was Friday the 13th?
Yeah,
this is scarier than any horror movie I've ever seen.
I'm terrified of the 4 o'clock hour because we're going to talk about Syria in a bit.
Okay, yeah,
that's not going to be good. 4 o'clock here is midnight in Syria.
All right. So, well, you made the switch. We're done with letters, so let's go there. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, yesterday I thought that we were backing off. I thought that Trump was trying to find an out by making his conciliatory comments.
It seemed like everybody was backing off. All
right.
Our allies were backing off.
Well, the allies are backing off because they deal like diplomats with adult tendencies. So they wanted to see the evidence. They had their own independent evidence. People had been smuggling out samples of the chemical that was used. The French intelligence have confirmed it's a mix of what we thought was sarin gas, which is a nerve agent that was carried in on the particles of chlorine gas, which is a choking agent. Sarin is not very persistent. Chlorine is not persistent at all. It chokes you. But they knew everyone would go down into the cellars. And by going into the cellars, the nerve, you know, one would force you down and choke you out. The other one would kill you dead. And by doing that, it just shows that they were, you know, they think Donald Trump is just a non-factor in this entire thing. And Trump made his famous tweet that his nice, smart missiles were on the way. But now I think he wants the Office of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to send in inspectors and to pull his chestnuts out of the fire. We can't do much. The Syrians have pulled out all of their high-value aircraft and have co-located them with the Russians. So it really wouldn't be worth anything.
So you don't think we're going to see...
I think we're going to strike because it's Friday the 13th. And all of the rest of the crazy, insane news we've had could provoke Donald Trump into wagging the dog very, very hard.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, I think Malcolm is absolutely right. They're going to have to do something because the macho president man is going to, you know, who tweets and who acts on impulse and who, you know, is not a long-term strategic thinker, will have to show the base and show the country that he's capable of it, and also that it's a terrific distraction from you-know-what that's going on in his own life. Mm-hmm.
The politics of distraction. Every time there's a major breaking story that's unfavorable, something happens that's initiated by the White House to draw attention away from
it. But that's every day.
Every day, yes.
Every day.
Yes, Joe, that's every day.
Can I point out that this is also still, all these actions over time could be found to be criminal as well. This is not maladministration, you know, as James Madison put it. This is actions where you are using the United States government for a personal effect in order to, you know, impact public opinion.
How do you approve that?
Well, I personally think that we have a special counsel that can investigate anything.
Yeah, you know, Malcolm, I have great respect for you, and you are certainly right that that's what's going on. But I also take Joe's question to you to be important, which is, how do you prove it? People have been doing this since the beginning of the presidency, this kind of thing. I think if you get them on something specific, you get them on a lie, you get them on this or that, you got them. But I don't see how this becomes actionable.
Well, if we have a debacle and people and service members die, and anyone with the slightest shred of honor in the Oval Office or in the national security apparatus has the ability to drop a dime, I think they will.
Okay, so what would the dropping of the dime look like?
Well, I've seen that before.
Yeah, but you know,
it look like?
This would be in the form of impeachment, I think, Alan. I think these people would testify before the House Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, considering articles of impeachment next year after the Democrats take the majority in the House of Representatives.
Which is, after all, a political action.
But
I think it would look like, and
I've seen this happen before, individuals walk into the office of the special counsel and say that I think that I've witnessed an activity which, even though apparently legal, could constitute a crime, and was done for purposes other than the good administration of the government.
Part of the issue here is that Trump says a lot, and sometimes it's contradictory. So, I mean, it gets to a point where people don't know what to believe. So, you know, we're going to pull out of Syria, we're going to add more troops, now we're going to bomb them, and...
We're waiting off now, we're holding off.
Sure, and I mean, it just goes back and forth to the point where, I mean... Forget about, you know, the voting public in the United States, but, you know, world leaders, do they pay attention to this? Are they taking it seriously? I think they can't afford not to take it seriously because it is being said, and he is the president of the United States. But at some point, it's just, I don't it's not crying wolf, it's shouting wolf in all capital letters on Twitter. But
I think
this is, I don't know, this is just so unsettling. And you see it with the TPP and all these other things where he's just flip-flopping back and forth. And there's a credibility issue, which is critical for any type of diplomacy.
I think they're ignoring us. I think, and except for the narrow areas where our, all of our mutual interests come together, like this thing on Syria. You see, France, Macron had to call Trump, right? And Trump was delighted. The British called them, and by actually involving themselves in so that they don't have to take unilateral action, they also can slow the roll on this activity, because resources have to get into place. British submarines are being tasked out to take part in a cruise missile attack. That takes 3 to 4 days. U.S. Carrier Strike Group now has to blast transit, as we call it, the Atlantic, to get into that area. And that gives you as much as a week to perhaps calm the situation down. But the Russians aren't having it. The Russians have made it clear, because they know Trump. Oh, they know Trump on a level none of us will know.
They probably have a better view than anybody, right?
Yeah, and they can record the watch the tapes.
And Malcolm, what is Bolton doing while all of this is going on?
Freaking Yosemite Sam.
Combing his mustache.
Good God. He is the man that I believe that provoked Trump into that first tweet the other day about the nice missiles. You know, we're going to go in there, we're going to smash. And then, as I can't recall the commentator on Twitter said, apparently 30 minutes later, Trump realized that he works for Putin, because the second tweet was a complete back off of that and said,
you
I want good relationships with Trump, with
you
Russia.
You are so right. The thing that is scaring the hell out of this guy is what the Russians can do to him. And, you know, nothing during this entire thing. The subordinates say thing about Russia, but you don't hear Donald Trump doing that.
It's amazing. I mean, forget about Trump for a second, that the national security yes, the national security apparatus hasn't learned that, and I forget who said it, strikes without strategy is a losing military option, because that's what happened in Iraq.
Right.
It created a power vacuum. ISIS came to fill it, and now look what's happening.
Well, let me ask you, Malcolm, do we have a strategy in Syria?
We do not.
Okay.
The strategy, I mean, the strategy that's in place right now. Full disclosure, Donald Trump claims and told Time magazine the last book he read was my book Defeating ISIS, which did have a strategy in it. And it had a lot of nice maps with arrows.
Yeah, but he lies about reading books.
I know. I had to say it. But that being said, my strategy was a humanitarian intervention by the Gulf state, you know, by the Saudis and the Gulf states. And that got a lot of discussion. Right now, the strategy is being developed by the Special Operations Command and the Joint Chiefs, and that is it's a local regional strategy that is to arm and assist the Kurds to evacuate ISIS, create a buffer along the Euphrates. Everything east of the Euphrates will be this sort of humanitarian zone. That being said, Donald Trump can't think past the first slide on his cartoon briefing page. If it doesn't have pretty maps on it, he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand that we must defend ourselves, and that's why we killed those Russian mercenaries that now Pompeo has verified that we killed 200 of them. The CIA director has verified that. And I'm sure that terrified Trump after that happened. But in terms of an actual strategy where we have gamed out what will happen for the next 10 years, not at all. He doesn't care about it. He's like Bush. They didn't want to know from any expert what would actually happen. Bolton, on the other hand, wants to use this as a springboard to invade Iran or to take down Iran.
And that's a different type of strategy that
help
is
let's
not even get into
that. We have multiple strategies going on simultaneously.
Yeah, but to what end? I mean, to me, the issue here is Trump runs for president and he says something that I think is probably right. We give arms to them and then they use them against us. They turn on us during this thing. So who are we for? We saw that Barack Obama would not be for Assad because he was killing people as a result of it. So is Trump for Assad? Is Trump for the rebels? I don't think so. That's why there's no strategy.
By extension, Trump is for Assad, is pro-Assad. He's a strong man. He does relate to it. That's very true. He completely supports the Kremlin's position on Syria. which is that the Kremlin will now have hold sway over the Assad components of Syria. He has no problem giving the Russians a warm water part in Latakia and Tartus, which is insane. If you can view it in the policy that we've been pushing for the last 70 years. And that means he has also agreed to give Iran free sway from the Golan Heights all the way out to the, you know, the Pakistani border, the Iranian crescent. But now he has Bolton on tap, who I think will probably try to convince him for weaponized regime change in Iran, which is crazy.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. Ruby Boots providing our music today from the album Don't Talk About It. Ruby Boots headlining the Roots Music Festival at the Linda tomorrow night, Saturday, April 14th, thelinda.org for more information. And you can see the playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, let's go on to other stuff here.
But before we do, Joe, I have a question.
Yes, yes,
I have
yes.
a question for all of you. Whatever happened to Steve Bannon? I mean, I'm hearing now that he's still in touch and he's advising Trump to go for it. In other words, to really open up on firing the special prosecutor and everybody else. Does he still have that kind of power?
Well, MSNBC reported yesterday that he's either literally or virtually back in the White House and influencing people. And there was some debate about whether he had physically come into the White House or whether he was just on the horn with Trump's advisors.
Oh, Trump.
Right.
All right. So let's go to other stuff. I do want to go to TPP, which you had mentioned, Aaron, and sort of this back and forth. Donald Trump has proposed rejoining the TPP. He did. He also tweeted about this morning, but in a sharp reversal, he told a gathering of farm state lawmakers and governors on Thursday that the United States was looking into rejoining a multi-country trade agreement known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a deal he pulled out of days after assuming the presidency. Mr. Trump's reconsideration of an agreement he once denounced as a rape of our country caught even his closest advisors by surprise and came as his administration faces stiff pushback from Republican lawmakers, farmers, and other businesses concerned that the president's threat of tariffs and other trade barriers will hurt them economically. Larry Kudlow, Mr. Trump's top economic advisor, said in an interview on Thursday with the New York Times that the request to revisit the deal was somewhat spontaneous. Mr. Kudlow said, the whole trade thing has exploded. There's no deadline. We'll pull a team together, but we haven't even done. I mean, it just happened a couple hours ago.
Hey, Joe, the keywords in what Trump said were looking into. You know, even when he's definitive, it means nothing. But if you say looking into, that may be to keep the farmers quiet for now.
Yeah.
I think there's a long distance between lip and cup here.
Well, that's right. I mean, similar to what he was, we're kind of going down that Docker road, right?
Right. Yeah,
this
sure.
is what we think we should happen, and then turns out. Aaron.
Yeah. Wow.
We're going to put you on the spot on this.
There's a lot to unpack here. So the TPP came about under Obama, and it was kind of surprising because most trade we have with most countries at this point is relatively free. Aside from Trump's proposed tariffs, that there's, you know, very little tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade. So what the TPP is, despite the bluster about, you know, free trade and all of this, is an investor rights agreement that gives, U.S. investors mechanisms to formally dispute legal issues within countries that they're doing trade with, and intellectual property protection and sanctions for violations on those in these countries. So there's nothing free about those. Intellectual property and copyrights are government-guaranteed monopolies. Those primarily raise the price of goods far more than any tariffs do. So you're looking at the entertainment industry with movies, and it's the pharmaceutical industry with drugs. So this is a heavy regulated, heavy managed trade agreement that has nothing to do with free trade.
Yes, but what does it have to do with it? It has been described publicly as a basic way of keeping the Chinese down.
Okay, right. Okay, so that's the second point, is that this is one way to engage Pacific Rim countries on U.S. terms and kind of force China to it sets a trade framework that China would have to follow instead of the U.S. following whatever agreement China makes with them. So there is some strategic political things here. But this is still a pro-business, pro-elite trade agreement. It's very clear that trade agreements like this lower wages for U.S. workers. They create job losses. The job losses with the TPP is not a substantial it's not going to be the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot said about NAFTA. It'll be a smaller sucking sound. So about 130,000 jobs would be lost. You're going to see lower wages in the manufacturing sector. So it seems like Trump's I was actually kind of happy when he came out in opposition to the TPP. That was one thing I agreed with, because it does not serve any workers' rights. But I think at this point, it's a midterm move coming from the fact that farm states and manufacturing states, the two industries that would be most affected by this, representatives from those states and business leaders are coming out saying, you need to do this. So this could very well be a midterm move on Trump's part to increase donor funding for Republican candidates in states like that. So that's my take on it.
It would certainly tamp down the sort of smoldering feeling among some of the people that voted for him who are now rethinking that. It would help get that support back out for the midterm.
True.
Yes, but what does it really mean? In other words, does he really have any intention, or is this just more, balderdash?
So he said that, he didn't say he was going to jump back into it. It would be he would need better concessions, primarily from Japan, and I think Japan has very clearly stated that they're drawing the line. They've provided as many concessions as they can. So is there a way forward for the U.S. to re-engage with this? I don't know, because you just can't believe anything this guy says.
Well, and in addition, Aaron, it has to do with his going back to his initial successes, which were as a broker of deals. That you threaten, you pull back, you go forward, but it doesn't have anything to do with a larger political or economic philosophy.
No, Japan's getting a lot of its beef from New Zealand at this point, and U.S. exporters of beef are very upset about that, because that's a major export market that's being lost. The other issue here is that, wages in China have gone up substantially over the past decade. So what the TPP does is it shifts these investor rights and intellectual property and the labor rights issues to lower wage countries like Vietnam, where workers are earning 50 cents an hour. So that's a very pro-business, anti-worker strategy that he's doing. And it's the bigger issue here is that him flip-flopping on these major agreements is creating so much uncertainty within the business community. That's going to slow the rate of investment. It's going to slow the rate of hiring. It's going to increase financial market volatility. And none of that is good for U.S. economic growth.
And so, Aaron, is that the reason why we see these humongous spikes and decreases in the stock market? Because everybody's trying to follow them with their logarithms and algorithms and all the rest of it, and they just don't know what to make of it all.
No, I mean that's what volatility looks like, is that you have these wild swings. We're going to have $150 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods, and now we're going to re-enter the TPP. So it's a heavily managed trade, and now we're talking about rejoining another trade agreement. This for the U.S. economy. I mean, in the aggregate, forget about the effect it's going to have on manufacturing workers. Is that the uncertainty this creates? Which again, Republican economists, John Cochran, Casey Mulligan, Martin Feldstein were just screaming about under Obama. They're noticeably silent now about that. And it's I agree with them. Uncertainty creates, it slows growth, it slows hiring, and it makes the U.S. economy less competitive overall.
But and it's a great distraction, too.
Yeah. There's that, too.
Trump thrives on chaos and uncertainty. He thrives on it. He needs it emotionally. And like I said, I just finished a book and on him and the Russians. And where he can get that rise, he'll get it. And as you said, Aaron, he clearly people have been now lobbying him about TPP. Right. And they finally said, you know, this is going to hurt soy farmers throughout the Midwest. I was just out in the Midwest, and they're pretty angry about this. And the Chinese, of course, are going to – I don't even recall how much percentage of tariff they were going to put on soy. I think it was something like 23%. But Americans are not – they're going to lose that market. And this is a good opportunity to lose that market forever because there are Latin American nations who are going to be in TPP who can start filling that void. China – and I've mentioned this on this program before – China's buying Africa and turning it essentially into a giant food – into a giant farm for China. And so if the United States doesn't want to maintain its dominance in this, we have to play in this game. But you can't have some, you know, a guy with a five-year-old attitude watching to see how it affects his personal portfolio.
Right.
He has to think about the nation first.
And, you know, informing your top economic advisor might be a good way to start and have some maybe internal discussions before you just blast this out on Twitter and leave your entire economic team scratching their heads saying, well, I guess this is going to be a busy weekend.
Nah. That kind of logic is why you're here and not in the White House there, buddy.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Malcolm Nance, and Aaron Pasitti. We will be right back after this short break. Infatuation will never do you good. True love don't come from just one night. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Friday the 13th. Yes, Friday the 13th. And we have a great panel. Alan Chartok is here. We have Mike Spain, Malcolm Nance, and Aaron Pasitti. Just a quick note that a week from today, we will be having our Roundtable Climate Change panel happening at Page Hall. This is a live event that will be broadcasting live from Page Hall, which is in downtown Albany on the State University of New York campus, University at Albany. Don't get mad at me, SUNY people. If you say SUNY Albany, they get very upset. So it's the University at Albany, the downtown campus at Page Hall, and we have a few tickets left, and you can go to wamc.org/roundtable and find out about it. And it's going to be from 9 to 11, but you can be in the audience. We've got hundreds of people coming. We're thrilled. And my God, what a stellar lineup. Alan and I will host. And then we've got Judith Enck. This is in alphabetical order. This is the way I've decided to do this. Judith Enck. Of course, our Judith Enck, the EPA, former regional administrator of the EPA. Also, we have Rolling Stone contributing editor and one of the great climate writers, The Water Will Come is his new book, and he is Jeff Goodell, will be with us. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and Pulitzer Prize winning author Elizabeth Colbert, who has written The Sixth Extinction, which is the book that won her the Pulitzer. She will be on our panel. And the ever-amazing best-selling author and also the writer-in-residence of the Harvard Divinity School and also teaching at Yale this semester, writing about the climate and our environment writing, is Terry Tempest Williams. So it's quite a group.
It's powerful.
Heavy hitters.
And we welcome you. All you have to do is go to wamc.org/roundtable. And you'll see we've got a pretty full house, but there's still a couple seats up there, and you can find them and check it out. We're going to have a book signing. We're going to have a great time. It's 2 hours, and it'll be a blast. So come join us. It's a week from tonight, from this morning. Yes, sir.
Joe, I wanted to ask a question of the panel, if I may, because I think it has taken a sort of backseat to our discussion. But I think this morning the potential for pardoning Scooter Libby it rings a sort of dark music in the background, because it clearly isn't about Scooter Libby, who already had his jail term commuted and all this, and is way off. But because I think it may be a signal to the others who are holding out, like Manafort and the others, the troops are coming. If I can pardon him, I can pardon you. Does anybody see anything here?
I think that's entirely plausible. I think that when Trump reaches out to somebody from two administrations ago and gives them a pardon, suggests he's ready to hand out pardons if anybody needs one.
Yeah. You know, I find it fascinating, this is Malcolm, I find it fascinating that he went after Scooter Libby, of all people. This is a man who, at the direction of the vice president, and also with the unindicted co-conspirator, Karl Rove, publicly released the name of a more than a CIA officer, a non-official cover CIA officer, a woman who is a personal friend of mine, Valerie Plame, who actually was running a secret program with 98 people to identify weapons of mass destruction, and they were as academics. Hiding in the world with no affiliation to the CIA, and they just thought this was fine. And it just goes to show that these people will do anything. So why did he pardon? Why is he going to pardon Scooter Libby? My guess is he'll make him chief of staff. I mean, this would not be the first time that a convicted criminal is working in the White House. Elliot Abrams. Yeah. Was pardoned and immediately got his top secret SCI clearance and started working in the White House. So I wouldn't be surprised if he brought Scooter Libby on board. It would make for a perfect adjunct to their criminal enterprise.
And by the way, I would like to make a rare apology for me.
I accept.
I have been hearing from a few people, because I've been comparing Trump to the Bushes and saying the Bushes were, you know, moderate Republicans. This all brings back all these nightmares that we were going through, especially with Cheney. And we like to call him Cheney because I think that's what he calls himself, as opposed to Cheney. And the nightmare that he and some of the people around him were committing during that time.
I think that Trump is starting to see the walls around him crumble, that he's feeling vulnerable with the Russia investigation, and that he's sending a signal to people who are already involved or have already been indicted, and this is a very loud and clear signal that, hey, I can be on your side if you need me, or more importantly, because I need you.
Well, I have to tell you, if we're going to be going back, one of the biggest supporters of Trump on the hard extreme is Oliver North.
Yes.
And I don't know whether you mentioned this week. There was a letter sent out by a group that's backed by Oliver North, which essentially said that a coup has been carried out against Donald Trump and that Americans should stand and be prepared to go to war against the government. This is just 2 days ago. I think it's called America.
I missed that.
America effort. It'll. I'm looking it up.
You know, Oliver North is a Capital Region native. He grew up in Columbia County. I just thought I'd mention that
what?
Local angle.
Yes.
The county where you live.
Where?
And we're proud of him.
Yes, very proud of him.
One bad apple doesn't ruin the bunch.
Help me, Jesus. So it explains
a
lot.
Okay. We have letters. Let's go to those, and that'll keep us going for a while. Greg says, to give President Trump some credit, one place he has maintained the international order and U.S. policy status quo is chemical weapons use. He's quickly and steadfastly condemned their use by Kim and Assad, responding with both soft and hard power. It's one of the few major issues that he has broken with President Putin over.
I mean,
how noble.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what is he going to say? Chemical weapons are good?
Exactly. I don't think that's a stance. That's like saying genocide bad.
Yeah.
Nancy writes and says, why would Assad use chemical weapons when he was on the verge of victory and Trump announced that he wanted to get out?
Uh-huh. There's a good answer to that, right, Malcolm?
Yes, there is.
He wants to create fear that if you mess up, we'll hit you with the chemicals.
Yeah.
All right. Pete writes and says, hello. Is anyone aware of the aspects of TPP that are unconstitutional and violate the sovereignty of the U.S.? I have read this years ago. Thoughts?
I don't know anything specifically, but the way the World Trade Organization works and the IMF and these essentially international super governments, there are laws that in trade agreements that can supersede national laws, whether those are investor right agreements or mandated protection of intellectual property. So I don't know any specifics, but there are laws that do supersede national laws, especially with the World Trade Organization.
Then we got this from Lee, who says, esteemed panel, per Homeland series, can Comey be considered a, quote, useful idiot, UI, in terms of being a Russian asset? This question is directed to Malcolm, of course.
No. Okay, let's go through the categories of idiots and assets. Yeah. First, there are three groups of people, well, four groups of people that work as foreign agents. One, you have unwitting assets. These are people who are manipulated. They have no idea that they're being manipulated or they're told there's some other government or entity. Second is a witting asset, which is somebody who knows precisely who's pulling their puppet strings. Then you have a witting agent, which is a person who actually signs a contract and is an agent of a foreign power or spy. Then you have useful idiots. And this is a old Soviet era term for people who were essentially either very mild-mannered fellow travelers, which, by the way, is another term, people who go along with them, or people who are just so stupid they don't know that they're being manipulated, and the things that they say work in your favor.
Hmm. Well, and one thing about Comey, there's going to be a lot of discussion about where Comey's coming from and why. Based on what I'm seeing, I don't see a lot of very healthy self-image on his part. And we see that with his apologia for the anti-Clinton nonsense that he pulled just a little bit before the election. He's apologizing all over the place. He says, oh, boy, I didn't mean it. I was nauseous when I saw the result. I was worried that it was me that was responsible for that. That isn't somebody with a strong self-image, I don't think.
No, but he's not a useful idiot. What's happened here is he played his role as he saw it. And if he's a useful idiot for anybody, it was for Trump, because Trump was pushing him. Donald Trump is a very you have to give him credit for the brilliance of his personal evil. I mean, he knows how to read people, and he knows how to manipulate people, but only on an extremely tactical level for whatever transaction is occurring in front of his face at that moment. And he has no idea by thinking that. Well, when he made his statement, he fired Comey, and he thought the Democrats would be happy because it was over the Hillary Clinton letter.
I mean, and by the way, a lot of Democrats were happy.
Yeah, okay. I haven't met them. But
at the time, remember, at the time.
Well, there were
the
some
moment.
Bernie supporters who validated their anti-Hillary feelings.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on. More letters. Susan says, never forget Comey threw the election to Trump. Comey is a big narcissist, is as big a narcissist as Trump. Loyalty, truth, lies, and leadership. Comey really needs to get over himself.
No, I don't buy that at all.
Me neither.
Yeah, I don't.
Comey is one of the few guardrails that you had.
I mean, you can look at stuff in his, I mean, I haven't read the book. I've read the excerpts that were in the Post and the Times, but yeah, there might be some self-justification and mea culpa on some issues. But I think as a whole, what he's talking about the White House being a forest fire and that, you know, what's coming out of there, that's the fake news.
Right.
I think it seems like most of the time he's just assessing it fairly neutrally.
I'm impressed with his professionalism and how he documented everything. He did not want to violate the law. He didn't want people, you know, he wanted Sessions to, like he told him, don't leave me in the room. You need to be between me and the president.
And when Sessions was there, he just stared at the table and his body language said, there's nothing I can do for you.
C-O-N-spiracy. That's how you spell that.
Patrick writes and says, dear panel, many of the countries in the TPP have advanced high-wage economies, so I failed to understand Aaron's comment on the negative impact on the U.S. employment if this country should join.
Okay. So, yes, there are I don't have in front of me the nations that are on there, but Vietnam and some of the Southeast Brunei, I think, and some Southeast nations. So, yes, it's not all of them. There are countries like Chile and others that are part of that. But, again, that's kind of the sideshow. The issue is the investor rights that the TPP grants to sue national governments over discrepancies about capital transfers and the heavy regulation of intellectual property and copyright law.
Right. And don't the signatories to the TPP agree ahead of time to accept the ruling of this international body, not their own government's ruling, and not challenge it in court?
That is correct.
I want to go back, if I may, Joe. I know it's annoying, but to Comey for a second. and say that I really don't like the idea of his being described as a narcissist. Donald Trump is a narcissist.
Right.
That there's no question. I think Comey is an insecure guy. I always have thought that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from what I've seen of him and people that I know who know him personally, you know, when you get to director of the FBI, you're gonna have a big ego. But that guy knew how to keep it in check. It's just on the big matters. He defaulted, like when he made the Clinton statement, which was unusual.
Yes.
The exculpatory statement. He felt that he needed to do that on a big stage. Then when he got cornered and realized the Republicans would savage him if the word got out that he had reopened that investigation, he did it again. And those are two points where I'm sure when we get the book, I'm sure he'll have regretted both of those.
So Malcolm, what was his sin there? His sin was that he got political when he should have been professional?
Absolutely. He should. If you want to be a Boy Scout, be 100% Boy Scout. Don't be the guy who sucks up to the Scout leader.
All right, let's go to, let's see, we have 3 minutes left. Roger writes, does the panel believe that Comey is in any jeopardy for conspiracy or any other wrongdoing with other members of the FBI and DOJ for conduct against Trump before or after the election?
Hell no.
What?
Hell no. Hell no.
That's a conspiracy theory. No, the guy did his job. You all want to send him to jail for doing his job? He's investigating essentially people who are running like a mob.
Although Trump will say all of that, right? I mean, Trump will say anything.
He said that on TV
himself
the other night.
Right, but he kept contemporaneous notes, and that's a practice that an FBI agent is trained in. So he has fresh documentation of every conversation he had, and that's the scary part here. That stuff holds up in
court.
What's
really scary is these people who are pushing that the FBI is in conspiracy to overthrow the government, and Oliver North sent a fundraiser out about that this week. This is really dangerous for this nation, particularly if a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda are sitting back and plotting a terrorist attack in the country.
So it is interesting, though, that Obama appointed Trump, right? Is that right?
Comey.
Comey. You're absolutely right. Sorry about that. And he knew that Comey was a Republican.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But some guys are there. Their jobs are apolitical.
Right? I think the stories are saying that Comey, who was a Republican all his life until recently. I think that's one of the phrases. Yes.
Well, according to Trump, they all became Democrats the minute Trump got elected.
Hey, if not now, when?
There's not a Democrat in this story.
All right. Joseph writes, Aaron has made an excellent point. Wages in China have gone up significantly in recent times. Herein lies the motivation for Trump's complaints about China and intellectual property. The American companies ran away from our workers toward China and clamored to give up their rights and to sign partnership agreements in exchange for cheap wages and no environmental restrictions. Yep. Now that they are losing profits due to Chinese workers now earning better wages, the corporations want the American taxpayers, whom they have screwed over and abandoned with no remorse, to front and attacked on China. The idea of helping those companies in any way is repulsive.
That's a great letter.
Yeah.
That
yes.
is.
Well said. Well said. Thank you.
Mitt Romney, ladies and gentlemen. Remember
all
that?
Right. Peter.
The reason really fast that it's a great letter is all of a sudden somebody's yelling, get those guys, get those Chinese. They're interfering with people in the United States at the very top making money. That's why we should have a world war. Yeah, right? Go.
Two letters, really quick. Peter, why Trump will insist on bombing Syria? It's because Obama failed to bomb Syria after drawing the red line, and Trump's highest political goal is to do everything the opposite of what President Obama did. Hold your thoughts, Malcolm, because Mary says, could Malcolm please discuss Russia's claim that a third party staged the gas attack on Syria?
Malarkey. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
technical
term, I think.
You know, the Russian propaganda machine is pumping this out right now. And believe it or not, Fox News is and the alt-right are ricocheting these hashtags that this was all a conspiracy, that the British might have done it, the Americans helped them do it. Hey, you know, like Al-Qaeda said, they sit in a cave for years thinking of doing something special, and you all want to take their credit, right?
You say malarkey, I say I call BS.
There you go. The Syrians did it. They've done it 60 times before. Yeah.
All right. On that note, we will end this morning. I thank you all for being with us. Alan, thank you. Good
thank
to
you.
Hear. Also, Mike, thanks for filling in. Appreciate it. Malcolm, it's always a pleasure when you're here. You're going to be out traveling the world, or can you join us next week?
Yeah, maybe next Friday.
We'll be in touch with your people. And Aaron, we'll be in touch with your folks, too.
Our people will be in touch.
Yeah, I was going to say, have your people call my people.
Excellent. Look forward to it. We'll be back right after this.